Hello, everyone. This is Frank Shines with Let In But Left Out. And I'm joined today by...
Grandison Shines.
Grandison, it's kind of, I guess it's not cold, but it's a little bit cool, kind of breezy. A lot of rain out here, really cloudy.
Rainy, huh?
A bunch of winter storms late last night, and our dog Ace does not like it, so he yelling and screaming, scratching his throat to come in. So he's underneath our bed most of the night. So how are things going out there in Arizona?
Things are going great. It is cloudy here. It sprinkled a little bit yesterday. I'm not sure if it's going to rain today and not having looked at the forecast, but if I go by strictly by looks, it looks like it is definitely going to rain. No wind. It would be good kite weather right now if there was some wind.
Right.
I'll settle for the rain if we get it.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, Umer's been, you know, doing a bunch of extra work. We're looking at a couple of different things that are associated with artificial intelligence visioning and moving some of the things over
Nice. The
websites and so forth. So he's been working around the clock. So we'll miss him today, but I'll update him on our conversation. He's always a pleasure to have. But today, got myself, Frank. We got Grandison out in Arizona. Umer's not going to be with us today, but the topic for the day, given February is Black History Month, so February 2021, Black History Month, what we want to cover is kind of a historical timeline, going from back K.D. Stroud and even prior to K.D. Stroud, and we'll talk more about the significance of him and his 11 children, to Johnny Shines, Delta Blues, my great uncle, to Goodman, Officer Eugene Goodman, and many of you have already heard a bit of the stories about him. We'll dive into that. It's a relevant conversation that's in the news today, given what happened with the Capitol mob insurrection. So that's the focus of the day. But as always, before we go into the topic for the day, a quick little bit of news. So in the news today, Grandison, let me know anything else you've been hearing out there. But one big thing is, you know, I used to live out in San Francisco, just right up the road from Chinatown. Every day I'd walk through Chinatown, Little Italy in Chinatown from Fisherman's Wharf area where I lived into the financial district where I worked with Ernst & Young and IBM, right, providing consulting services for companies like McKesson Corporation, one of the largest healthcare distributors. And Chinatown is so interesting. That one of the things that's, you know, you get on the bus sometimes when it's raining, you get on the bus and literally you'll smell the different types of food that people eat as they get onto the bus when you're going through Little Italy versus Chinatown, right? I still remember that to this day. You smell the different flavors of people get on, you smell the coffees and stuff like that from all the folks with the fresh roasted coffees and cappuccinos and everything getting on. And then, you know, by the time you get to Chinatown, you smell the garlic smells and some of the other, you know, teas and things of that sort. And then you're back into the financial district. But really interesting experience living right there in San Francisco for more than 6 years. You and I would catch up and meet and talk about a lot of these ideas. But really unfortunate incident has been the data that they now have. They just reported out in San Francisco and a few other places like New York and other places, Southern California, where they have high percentages of Asian populations. And hate crimes, depending on different data sources, were up over 1,000%, many cases 1,500, 18%, as reported by police organizations in New York, San Francisco, and other locations. And so obviously a lot of this was driven by concerns around the coronavirus pandemic, but right, more so the language that was used to describe it by Trump when he,
correct,
you know, used a number of racial terms and slurs. And so what have you been hearing about it? I know you guys probably don't have as large a percent of Asian population down there, but what are your perceptions and thoughts about this story?
Yeah, not a large population here, but definitely been hearing about it. It's in the Bay Area more so where it's been happening, and it's been a lot against or towards the elderly, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Die. Yeah, this is ridiculous.
That 84-year-old guy, they pushed down and he died a couple days.
He died, right? A couple days later, he died from injuries. Mm-hmm. I believe the story goes they arrested a 19-year-old kid or something like that. That was the cause of that.
Right.
And other types of things that have been happening. And it's very unfortunate, but it definitely is, definitely from the rhetoric and the stir of emotions from the language that Donald Trump has been using. And one of the things we teach in our communication, leadership, accountability courses is that the words you use can incite or stir up an emotion or emotions, a myriad of emotions. And if you understand that, and I believe he understands that, and he's using it to the point where, it is definitely stirring up emotions. And we've seen that happen at the insurrection. We've seen it happening now in terms of the general populace towards the Asian community. Very unfortunate. Extremely unfortunate.
I think that also played a role in Georgia. My understanding was that for the first time, and I'm going to look up some of the data. I don't want to misspeak. I don't recall the exact sources. So as we're speaking, and I can find out the exact sources, I'll speak to it. But first of all, anecdotally, I've got a lot of Asian friends. Obviously, for some of the businesses we've run, I spent a lot of time over in China. Mm-hmm. And with the custom flash drive business, we still continue to interface with folks over there. And one of my, one of the key people that reviewed the book for us, Dr. Peter Wong, he gives me a lot of insight in terms of the Asian community, both, back in Taiwan and other parts of Hong Kong, as well as mainland China, where he has family, as well as what's happening here in the States, right? And, some of the information that I've been getting from a number of close friends around this has been, for the first time, they're getting away from this belief of just being the quiet, and I can't recall the term is, it's like the perfect minority group, right? They're kind of known as, mm-hmm. the good minority group or something, the terminology that's used sometimes. And they're now becoming more resentful of some of these things historically that have happened where they've been silent, not necessarily come out. And in Georgia, we saw examples of them coming out and coming together as part of whether it's the liberal or the, Black Lives Matter movement or the, gay and lesbian community, but understanding that this whole area of civil rights has a direct impact on them in ways that maybe they before wouldn't necessarily speak out about. And let's admit, when you've got some of the other challenges in terms of potential, immigration issues and deporting, your family members, then it's much more difficult perhaps to speak up. But all those things seem to have come to a tipping point after seeing some of these hate crimes and how they were depicted here in America. And so the Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders are really standing up now. And we're seeing a lot more happening with them. And you're also seeing it, I know here back east, we're seeing a lot more vocal communication in the media, in both national and local media, where more and more Asians are participating. So, some observations I've had, and I'll try to pull up a couple of data points on some things as we speak through this as well. But I think they played an important part also in helping tip the election in Georgia.
Yeah, absolutely.
Labor participation rate. So this the labor participation rate is just one of those long-term trend things that I've always been fascinated by and kept an eye on. So in a couple of other podcasts that we, talked about, we've looked back at, going all the way back to 1940s, just like this chart shows it back to 1950s. But we've seen trends where the productivity, GDP of the U.S. is a bit just constantly going up from the 1940s all the way through to present day, slowed a bit, but still going up quite nicely. And then if we looked at, how that compared with wages, we saw it going up as well. And then in 1970, mid-70s, we saw it begin to decouple, and the wage rate was flattening out, right, relative to the GDP. Another long-term curve is this thing they call the labor participation rate. So, you know, when you look back in the 1950s, less, right around 50, 54% of the labor market was participating, largely because a lot of women had not yet entered the workforce, right? And so over time, you saw that this number has gone from 54% up to about 60.5% in the mid 70s. And then by the mid 80s or so, it was well over 64%. And it's reached a peak of between 67% and 68%.
Right.
So, you know, that's part of the way they also understand, you know, kind of full employment and those sorts of things as well. But the participation rate is really super important. And now you're seeing it drop off. Now, part of the reason it's dropping off is because of the baby boomers that are retiring. But for the first time you saw it, you know, it's been dropping off. And then it started to try to come back a little bit. And then coronavirus hit and it just dropped off like a rock. Recently, it's been right around 63%. But now it's dropped off to 61%, 2 points. And this has been since the worst point of coronavirus. So it's appeared to have dropped a bit again, even. So there's a lot of concerns about, are people checking out now and not going to come back anymore? There's data that shows the women, when they look at the women workforce and kind of strip that out, because you have the high percentage of women that are essential workers, and teachers, and disproportionately in healthcare, nursing, and those sorts of functional areas. They say the data that they're looking at now is setting back the women workforce 35 years.
Wow. So
literally back to the 70s, late 70s time frame, maybe 80s, but right in that time period. So pretty significant impact on the women labor participation rate.
Wow, that is a huge impact, huge, huge impact. On the other side of that, what I've also been hearing, listen to this one gentleman on YouTube, and he's kind of a relationship expert, kind of, he's an image consultant, his name is Kevin Samuels, I don't know if you heard of the name before. That's really good content, and he talks to a lot of ladies in terms of what their perception are in terms of getting into a relationship with a man, preferably one that is of a quote higher value, and right, what their thought processes are in terms of getting one. And I'm hearing more, and he asked, the good thing about this, he asked the same question. So I believe he's collecting some data, but you can definitely tell that. And he said that some of the women that he's asking the question to, a lot of them are looking for someone to take care of them and they want to be out of the workforce. One of the question he asked is, do you want to work once you have a kid, or once you get into a relationship, you have a kid with the gentleman, do you want to work to pay significant bills? And the answer is no. That's it. Do you want us to be a stay-at-home mom? And they're like, yes.
Right.
So it's amazing how this correlates exactly to what he's saying in terms of the participation rate and women being in the marketplace. At the same time, they are pushing more towards education. And in fact, there are more women in college than men now. So it's somewhat skewed, but I definitely see what the audience is saying, that's for sure. And they're saying, right, we want out of the workforce. So
interesting. Yeah. I mean, you bring up a good point, because I can think of a number of different examples where, you know, I've had women reporting to me in different work environments, and, you know, they would confide in me the fact that, you know, they feel the discrimination, the misogyny and so forth. And just kind of this feeling that, you know, they need help with coding, and the others will huddle on weekends or after work, the men, and help each other out. And, you know, they'll kind of kick the women to the side. And, you know, there is, Yeah, I think a growing percentage of women who are just, you know, fed up with it, right? Let me stay home. Maybe I'll figure out a way to do things remotely. Don't have to go into office and deal with some of this crap. They don't necessarily buy into it. And to be honest with you, right, that's part of the way a lot of African Americans feel, right? They don't have this like loyalty to some corporation. You know, this ties back into the topic of the day. We're going to look at the history, but you know, when I went back and I looked at the way the Emancipation Proclamation was written, and we put this in the book where we talk about how that was written, where it said, you know, you basically, you're free, but you can't leave the slave owner. And now you get wages, whatever they choose to pay you. Right. Yeah. And so fast forward to 2020. And if you got a whole history of how that whole labor employer relationship was set up as part of your quote unquote emancipation, your freedom, right? Yeah. I mean, you can't blame them. I get where a lot of women are coming from. I see your point there. I was able to find some information. Yeah. So let me just say, so James Wu, Asian American out in Georgia, writes for the Advancing Justice Atlanta organization. So this is January 6th, just last month. And he writes here, following a record-breaking turnout in the general election, Asian American and Pacific Islander voters in Georgia cast ballots in historic record numbers for the Senate runoff. And obviously that's runoff race, essentially tipped the scale of power to the Democrats because it essentially tied the senatorial 50-50. And with Vice President Kamala Harris, she becomes the tying vote. We now have, the Democrats now have voting authority. So facing a COVID-19 pandemic, closures of early voting locations, language barriers, and heightened fear and intimidation about voting, our communities overcame unacceptable barriers to exercise their right to vote. So this is part of Asian American Advancing Justice in Atlanta organization. So yeah, there's some of the information that kind of goes back to that point that we were talking about earlier.
Right.
Next topic, Twitter bans Trump for life. Not just before they temporarily banned him. They wouldn't say what was going to happen, but in their earnings call report out this week, they made it very clear, Jack Dorsey, that Trump has been banned for life. So what are your thoughts about that? What do you know, from a technology perspective, social media, private, you know, freedom of speech versus understanding security and privacy and rage and all those things online, as well as from Trump's perspective, or perhaps the perspective of anyone who can use Twitter in a way that Trump did or others might in the future to garner support and perhaps even get people outraged in a way that isn't necessarily always beneficial for the Republic, the United States overall, and for democracy. What are your thoughts?
Well, absolutely. Twitter has the right to ban, and there is the trials going on right now, whether or not this is freedom of speech or whether or not because of the power and authority he had, he could really incite violence or incite movement, of course, in the direction that it had, that it did go, I should say, not happen, but that it did go on January 6th. And Twitter, they have rules, right? So you can read them. And every time we set up an account, there is the opportunity to read the Twitter rules. I'm not 100% sure on what they say. I haven't looked into it yet, but I was going to definitely look into that. But in terms of context and what you are or what you can and cannot say, of course, anything that, and I agree with them, on that is of inciting of violence or any other rhetoric that creates a mob that is going to be violent, I believe that there should be a limitation on what you can say. And or as Trump got the suspension of his account. And that's something that I believe it's warranted in this case. if you look, listen to the words, and they've been playing it on NPR, the news, quite a bit, and the attorneys going back and forth, and lawyers, and to me, it's very, very clear, and I understand that other politicians have used the word fight before in their speeches, but this one, you can tell, is totally different. The context in which it came about was different, and if I were Twitter or any other social media, I would definitely consider revoking his account as well.
Right.
My position on it. What do you think?
Yeah, no, agreed. Obviously, it's a key discussion point throughout the book. And, you know, there's going to be, without a doubt, there are going to be some legislation under the Trump administration
sure.
to begin to hold all the social media account, social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Google, others more accountable for their actions. And I think it's basically going to be a tweaking of the Section 23 rule, which essentially says that a social media or an online platform is not responsible for the content that people post on their sites. I think there's going to be they're going to start putting some guardrails around that. And I think it's super critical. It's critical. I'll say, when we talk about the impeachment part here, maybe this is a good segue into it, because if you look at the impeachment trial, even, you can see where the way the Democrats brought information forward, it was clear that there are two completely distinct filter bubbles or alternate universes of communication that were out there. Where you could see, you know, an average person, or person that was not an extremist, was moderate, that understood logic and had critical thinking skills, all the things that we talk about, and has some sense of concern and empathy and morality, saw the world one way, and others saw it completely different. And so I think it's critical, if we expect to have a democracy, the whole reason we have a democracy is we went through this whole Enlightenment period,
right,
where we said we're not going to allow, you know, dictators, authoritarian figures, the nobility, royalty, right, and popes to run our lives. We're going to use science, and we're going to make up our minds on our own, and we're going to vote as a block of people that can agree to what truth is and cooperate flexibly in large numbers to make things work. That was the whole idea of everything that was put into our Constitution, learned from the scientific revolution and learned from the Enlightenment and learned from all the atrocities and things that took place over in Europe. So to think that, you know, fast forward 250 years roughly, we're now going to go in reverse and unlearn all the things that we know better not to do, except now we use a different communication form of doing all the things we know we shouldn't do. It doesn't matter, right? It doesn't matter if it's radio one year or television the next day, or, you know, a carrier pigeon. If you're using communication, a communication vehicle in a way that distorts truth, rips people apart, enrages, the future of your democracy is going to be limited, right? And right. It's the whole thing that we talked about a couple of weeks ago when we went through the history of how the Constitution was set up and the concerns that the founding fathers had. And if, in fact, you can take any autocratic individual and they can use a communication medium to whisper in the ear a completely different, or yell with a megaphone in the ears of their audience, a completely different reality to the tune of I think the latest number is $150 million of advertising. Then that's going to have an impact. I mean, I'll just confess, even me, when I listen to Fox News, not Fox News too long, sometimes I'm not sure if I know my name, right? I don't know who I am anymore. You can listen to some news and you know something's wrong, but you hear it said over and over and over again. And after a while, you start wondering, well, maybe I ought to check in it. Maybe there could be some truth to certain things, right? And it's not to say you don't keep an open mind and understand all points of view, but then you got to step back and put on good judgment and critical thinking skills and say, you know, no, that's crap. If it's crap, right, and call it crap, call it out. But so my sense is that Twitter is going to benefit financially from this. And this past year, you've seen them up like 20%. Initially, they were down for a few weeks or so when they first banned Trump, but now their stock is back up. And there's a lot of conversation around them perhaps trading a subscription model, or at least part of the platform with a subscription model, where they can begin to control these things a little bit better and prevent a lot of the anonymity that drives some of the rage online. So yeah, I'm with you there. I think that was a smart move, and I think it's going to be good for democracy, both. Yeah. So it's going to be good financially and democratically.
Politically. Very true. I agree with that. Absolutely.
So the impeachment, second impeachment trial of Trump started this week. And what are your initial thoughts about what you've been seeing and hearing?
Initial thoughts is it's up in the air. I hear, of course, the side that's more, well, let me talk about Donald Trump's side first. I understand their points, and I'm more thinking about, will some of those points actually make it across the aisles and ears of the people who are going to actually make a decision for whether it's full impeachment or not, or whether it's actually going to go through or not. What I'm saying is, they have some arguments that, and I'm trying to put it in light the way I was listening to it and the way they were explaining it. They have some arguments that may, even as charged as his words were, his defense is painting it to the fact where it will basically take the charge out of the, and I forgot the terminology they used, take the charge out of the words and make them seem very, very neutral and very, very common in terms of political speech, when that was not the case. You can, and they played a longer video. It is clearly not the case, of course, if you listen to Trump's speech of what he wasn't talking about. Now, on the other side of that too, from Trump's side, being a leader at that caliber, you should know that your words have a significant effect on people. Yeah, it has a significant effect on the marketplace or the mindset of the people that are listening and that are your supporters. And we know what kind of supporters you had. Sometimes they were a bit aggressive. And when you add that to the medium used and how he used it and what transpired, to me, it was clear that, yeah, this definitely needed to be happening as far as an impeachment trial from my standpoint. But
Exactly. They're definitely not going to have the votes. I mean, unless something completely, you know, out of the blue happens, major surprise. They're not going to get the additional 17 votes from the other side of the aisle.
Right.
Certain numbers, looks like maybe they get 5 or 6, possibly even 7, but certainly not 17 that are required to get to 2/3, because the Democrats have 50. So you'd have to be at 67. So you get 17 more that would have to move over from the Republican side. That's not going to happen, but I agree. We have got, we got to send a clear message for future generations, and we have to put in place a deterrent. I mean, can you imagine if what is deeply concerning to me is similar to what we saw with school shootings, right? The first time this happened, Colorado Columbine, you know, the whole world stopped, an American stopped, and, you know, and everyone came out and spoke strongly in defense of the need for protecting our children and protecting our schools and ensuring that this doesn't repeat, and strong concerns around, you know, gun control and so forth. And now today, you know, just here in Florida, right? We had a bunch of kids shot up, and we've got people in Congress now who say that these incidents didn't happen, right? None of the incidents associated with the shootings, shootings in the Northeast or the shootings in Southeast and Florida and in schools, none of that ever happened. that's how far we've come, and to the point where Americans don't even think much of it when 30, 50 people are shot and there's a mass shooting these days. And I think the same thing can happen with regards to this this lack of sensitivity, this where now it becomes normal that anytime we have an election, we're going to have, you know, people storming the Capitol.
Right? Yeah.
We're going to, you know, kind of degrade to the point of this spiral downward, you know, point of the lowest common denominator of behavior, that now it's okay to have capital insurrections whenever there's a disagreement on electoral voting. And then where does it go? Does it go to every state after that as well? And we just take that for granted. Oh yeah, that's fine. It's okay. Right. I think we have to send a very strong message here. Mm-hmm. And I heard one individual make a comment about, well, it's not likely that Trump is going to run for election again, given all of these things that have happened. And particularly, you know, this becomes kind of a deterrent to that. And someone said, well, even if he runs, he's not going to get reelected. And then another observation was, what's even worse is if he runs and he doesn't get reelected and loses, what happens then? We have another one of these insurrections, but possibly much worse, because he hates to lose, right? So it's extremely dangerous. Dangerous for the reasons that others can follow his lead, dangerous for the reasons that we can all become desensitized to this and think it's okay and normal, dangerous to the point that he could actually get back in the race in 2004, run again and lose again and have even more of a negative impact and more violent outbreak across the nation as a result.
I have not seen a sore loser at this height in the game or at this height in our, in any branch of government that we've had yet. I haven't in my lifetime. This one, he really takes the cake. And I really feel that there should be a message sent, like you're talking about, strong message sent, not only sore loser, but because of that, I don't know, the entitlement. It's narcissistic for sure. that's for sure. Right. But if this, it can really, if we don't step into what failure of imagination, we can imagine what can happen if he does run again in 2024 and lose, incite more violence, just like you said. It can be very daunting to the American spirit when it comes right down to it, of the people.
You know, the other thing that strikes me is, are the people who are standing up the strongest on the Republican side are the women, right? From Alaska, Susan Collins up in the Northeast, Liz Cheney, right? Her comments out of Wyoming. The president of the United States summoned this mob, assembled the mob, and lit the flame of this attack, right? Powerful words, but I've been really impressed by the women who have had the courage to stand up in light of the events and know that they're putting their futures at political risk, which gets back to the labor participation rate again, right? That they never really bought in, just like African Americans haven't necessarily bought in to the way a lot of white Anglo men buy into capitalism. Sure. And the labor market, and the women are basically saying the same thing. And if it comes down to my integrity and what's really right,
they're going
to stand up. Yep. They're more likely to stand up for what's truly right.
Right, exactly. But you have the other men, the Republican men, who are being more sycophants, and they are worried about putting their political career in jeopardy because of not supporting Trump and the reach he has, even outside of the walls of the President of the United States. And they are concerned about it affecting their career.
Yeah.
I get it, but have a backbone, have a spine. You know that was definitely wrong in that sense. And
Yeah.
You know, at least Lindsey Graham finally came around and for my thought process and had an idea to really stand up against it. Now he felt that the impeachment shouldn't happen, but at least he's like, I don't have anything to do with Trump again. Right. So
yeah, and then he's kind of backed away from that as well. I mean, yeah.
Oh, he's back away from that too?
And others. So we're in day five.
Mm-hmm.
They met, the Democrats presented their case, the Republicans presented their case, and this morning they opened at 10 a.m. and they were supposed to make some closing kind of remarks on both sides and then cast the final votes. More than likely early this afternoon, maybe even as early by 3 o'clock, we'd be done. But instead, Raskins, the Democrat side, came out this morning and brought up a request for at least one, possibly two people
witnesses
to be witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Republicans came back and countered it. They ultimately presented some quick remarks, arguments on both sides, voted 45 to 55 that they will allow witnesses. And so now they are in recess, or they may have just returned from recess, but they're when we started, they were just ready to go into recess to come back and decide how many witnesses would be allowed or whatever else might come up. So everything was thrown into a complete surprise this morning based upon the opening remarks from the Democratic side. Now, there was some news that came out late yesterday that something like this was brewing, but now rather than this closing today,
mm-hmm.
there's a good chance it's gonna go many more days, possibly more than a week, and
right.
kind of all bets are off. Right? And who knows where mm-hmm. this goes from there, right? And a reason for it, by the way, is, you know, back to your point about, so there's one thing, even if you want to say, listen, give him all the benefit of the doubt, give Trump all the benefit of the doubt around freedom of speech, and he passes, you know, all the criteria for, he passes all the criteria that prove that he did not incite the insurrection because of free speech. Okay, give him that. So the big question that is pending here is comments by Jamie Herrera out of Washington State, who basically says she heard the conversation that even during the insurrection, that Trump did not come to the aid, he was on a phone call, did not come to the aid of the Vice President Pence, who was in danger, nor any of the other members of Congress, right? And yeah. so now what that does is it tells you something about state of mind. And that's almost psychopathic, right? To think that, you yeah. know, you are watching, and you know he's watching TV and he's seeing this, he knows it's all going on. And you have the opportunity, right? And depending on where you want to take the numbers, the count and the stop times, 2.5 hours, 3.5 hours after the insurrection before he actually does anything. Somewhere in that range, depending on how you want to count the start and end point. But even 15 minutes after the insurrection, not doing anything as president of the United States, that's derelict in all your duty, right? Half an hour, definitely a big issue. An hour later, 2 hours later, 2.5, right? Before you actually come out and say anything, and all of Congress, an equally viable and powerful part of the U.S. Makeup of our legislative, executive, and judicial branches, right? And to not come to the aid of those individuals, and more importantly, your own vice president,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that the second and third in succession also are at risk, and to do nothing, and does that beg the question that you wanted this to happen? So perhaps you can lose. We can wipe out the second and third and first, second and third in succession. And or yeah. that you can be in a position where you can declare martial law and therefore retain power. I mean, it just brings up all sorts of questions. So that's the reason why they've gone into recess to discuss this.
Very clear. The message is clear to me.
There's my-
I forgot how that saying goes, but sometimes not doing anything is
yes.
compliance, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Very that's much right. so. Exactly what happened. There's an old adage around that. I don't recall it at the moment, but that's exactly what happened. Well said.
Definitely. Okay, topic for the day. There's the news, kind of a tie into the impeachment last night, following the completion of work related to the impeachment. The Congress voted unanimously to give the Congressional Gold Medal to Officer Eugene Goodman. He's the individual who used himself as kind of a ruse, a pawn, was a rabbit to the fox, lured them away, the mobsters away from the chambers where the congressional members were. They followed him and consequently
right.
Bought time for many of the members to find safety. So he played a critical role in minimizing a lot more violence and potentially saving lives. So
right.
good for him. We are in Black History Month, so this is why we're going to spend some time talking about Eugene Goodman, but we're going to kind of do a full arc of the history of America from the perspective of, you know, an African-American and I guess an indigenous American tribe, which is part of our family's history as well, to present day. And so with that in mind, we'll kind of talk about Reverend K.D. Stroud, who was, his siblings were slaves. He just happened to be born just a couple of years after Emancipation Proclamation. So consequently, he was not a slave. He was considered a freedman, but he was still born on a slave plantation and he had to stay and remain on that slave plantation for the reasons we talked about earlier. Regarding how the rules around Emancipation Proclamation were outlined at the very beginning. It did not mean people could just walk away and were free. They had to stay put in place on the plantations.
Right.
To Johnny Shines, the Delta Blues, me and Grandison's great uncle on the father's side of the family. So we'll just kind of walk through some of this and tell some of the stories and kind of the history of that. So Grandison, about Eugene, we're going to start with him and then kind of go back and then come back for a full cycle. So really impressive. He is a resident of Southeastern Washington, D.C. You know, he grew up there, went on out of high school into the U.S. Army, where he served in Iraq. I believe it was 2002 to 2006. He served over in Iraq with the 101st Airborne Division, and then received a job working as there in Washington, D.C. as a security person, and moved up to the ranks to become one of the key officers in the Senate, and of course, on January 6th during the insurrection. You can see the pictures that we have here of him in some cases kind of fighting off and slowing down the mob, in other cases derailing them, tricking them to going down one hall in order to protect some of the locations where members of Congress were located. So really great story. I don't know if you know much more or heard much more about some of what he did. Any other anecdotes or stories to add?
Not much more to add, but I do want to say that watch the video that when he got the standing ovation from Congress or from the Senate, that was very much moving, and that light to give him that recognition. That's good. Very proud of this young dude. I think he was like 41 years old.
Yeah, 40. Right? Yeah, 40. I think 41 years old. Yeah.
Yeah. So He just took matters in his own hand during that day, during all that pressure and everything else, and all the emotions that were going around. He remained calm and did what he was supposed to do as an officer, keep them to protect and serve as he did. And I believe that the Congressional Gold Medal award for him is very much so deserved.
Yeah, just think of the contrast between some of this, sorry, but some of the spineless individuals in Congress who want to keep their $175,000 job, and someone like this who almost gives it, who's willing to give up his life to defend
them. Yeah.
And then the individuals like himself and the others that now are scraping feces from the walls and blood of some of their servicemen from the floors, most of them Black and Latino Americans in Washington, D.C., cleaning up from these mobs.
Yeah. Very much so.
Yeah. So what we're going to do is kind of walk through a bit of the history of the Shines family. What we've done is we've got a timeline. And for those of you who are listening to the podcast, hopefully you'll have a chance to go to the gallery part of our website and click on the video, and you'll see all the pictures and see the full timeline. So if you're going to just think of it this way, we went and looked at the family history as written in a number of different books, books by other historians, by congressional records, unfortunately, through the slave schedule, data that is available to us, and then analyze it through the DNA profile, our ancestral DNA through 23andMe, and trace everything back. And we talk about all of this whole history in the book. Right. So what we've got here is kind of a timeline that goes from 1690, where we can see the first Africans come over from parts of Ghana, mostly into the United States, where, you know, this is the beginning of our family. And, you know, we've got a picture of 1620, the Plymouth Rock, and then a, you know, pattern of pictures moving from left to right to present day 2021. So that's kind of what you're looking at. We'll kind of talk through that. And what I'll do is maybe first, from the perspective of the Stroud side of the family, make a few comments and then go into the Shines side. Unfortunately, the Stroud side of the family kept more records and data and information and have done more research. So we're able to provide a lot more information on that side of the family. But we'll also talk through what we do know about the Shines side of the family and kind of how they migrated across from Mississippi and Oklahoma to Idaho and ultimately to, you know, to the West Coast, primarily California, all up into Washington State and Arizona, where Grandison is currently today. So with that, in the book, we spend time going through the history. And from the Stroud side of the family, essentially we're showing a picture of Carl Bolduc, who was a French Canadian. He, along with a group of individuals, the Irish McGees, were part of the Revolutionary War. And because of the Revolutionary War, the McGee side of the Stroud family became a freedman because they helped fight against the British on behalf of the Americans. So as a result of that, they were allowed to be freedmen up in the northeastern part of the U.S., New England area. And they ultimately migrated down from the Northeast and settled into Missouri and Oklahoma area. And one of those is James McGee, who wrote a book about a lot of the history and things that happened right prior to and after Emancipation Proclamation. Again, he was a freedman, so that's why he was able to write books as an and he was a famous abolitionist, author, and statesman. And then coming out of that, his niece was my great great grandmother, Lulu McGee, whose family also walked the Trail of Tears. She was part of the Creek Native American indigenous tribe. And so she had settled down in Oklahoma. At that time, it was not called Oklahoma. It was called the Indian Territory. And my great-grandfather ultimately met her when he, K.D. Stroud, who was the individual on the reservation in Texas, he was on an Indian reservation that was owned by Mandrell Stroud. And the Stroud name, obviously, the McGee's come from either side of the ancestral strain. And then the Stroud is a British name. So down in Texas, a place called Limestone, Texas, near the Brazos River area, is where they had a number of different reservations. And the owner of the reservation, his son, became infatuated with one of the slaves. My great, great, great grandmother, she was full Ghanaian slave. She married the son of one of the slave owners. That son of the slave owner, whose name was Luis, he was half British and half Tawakonian Indian. So because he was kind of considered a sibling to the others, to the other white children of Mandrell Stroud, he was not kind of he was looked down upon. He was not necessarily always allowed in the big house, so to speak. So that's part of the reason why he, you know, developed an affinity for the African American slaves, because he was a mixed breed. So once they married, not long after that, Emancipation Proclamation came, and because of the carpetbaggers and taxing from the north of the southern plantations, and because of the concerns that his son and their family would always be discriminated against in Texas, Mandrell took his family, Luis and my great grandfather, Katie, out of Texas, and moved them and their family to Indian Territory to escape racism. So kind of an interesting, you know, juxtaposition of different stories and histories of backgrounds of people. But that's how the K.D. Stroud, ultimately Reverend K.D. Stroud, went to school at Langston University, got his degree, worked for a law professor, because his father dealt with slavery, had to understand math and accounting, and transfer some of that knowledge onto his grandson. And K.D. Stroud ultimately met the young lady, Lulu McGee, who I talked about from the other side of the family, that was now living in Indian territory as a Creek Native American Indian. They met in church. They saw what was happening with Oklahoma becoming a nation, a part of the American nation, becoming a state, granted statehood. And once statehood was to be granted, they knew what was going to happen. Discrimination, the Ku Klux Klan, segregation, and all those things now were imposed. So they immediately sought refuge in a different location, picked up their family, and moved their family from out of the Indian Territory that had now just recently become the state of Oklahoma to Colorado, where there was not segregation, in order to raise their children in schools where there was not segregation. And that had a profound impact. 11 of his children went on to just do some incredible things, and we'll talk more about it, or read the book and you'll be able to hear more about it. But fast forward, my grandfather, Tandy Stroud, great man, he moved his family out to Colorado. My mom, his daughter, ultimately married my father, you know, Grandison's father, Franklin Shine Sr., and they got married out in the Bay Area, and kind of, you know, the rest is history. But an important part of also what happened was my mother's closest brother, Joseph Stroud, is an individual that I've had a chance to work with quite a bit, selling candy as a little kid out in East Palo Alto, just jumping out of the van and selling like peanut brittle candy and all sorts of things like that. I still remember those days. But he went on to become one of the richest African Americans, and you'll see the pictures of him with President Clinton and his wife, my aunt, Aunt Joanne Faddis, who also is the daughter of John Faddis, the famous trumpet player that played with Dizzy Gillespie and Louis Armstrong and all the other great jazz players. So that's how we went from the slave house to the White House. That's kind of the quick background and history of our, the Stroud side of the family and the Shine side of the family. We don't have as much information about, but my great grandparents were in Mississippi. They migrated from Mississippi to Oklahoma. And in Oklahoma is where my father was born, in Frogville, Oklahoma, for similar reasons, discrimination and the fact that my our grandfather, Grandison's grandfather, my grandfather, whose name was also Grandison. He was the first Grandison. Reverend Grandison picked up his family and moved from Oklahoma to Idaho. One, to scrape a lot of the racism and the segregation and so forth that was happening in the South. And also because he was a traveling minister. So that's what brought my parents together, because they both had similar backgrounds in terms of how their families had migrated both from Oklahoma into Western states, Colorado and Idaho, which aren't too far from each other, and ultimately met up in California. So Grandison, another background, comments, thoughts you want to add on the Shine side of the family? Or obviously Johnny Shines is the Delta blues player that we talk about, and he's depicted here in the picture as well. Other thoughts or comments?
No, it's been a tremendous honor just to learn a lot about this side of the family and understanding even more and more. Exciting on where we're going, because what we're doing, and we've always talked about this, is also going to not only make it into hopefully our family history, but at the same time shape and redirect the history as well, making sure that we provide a pathway to where extended family can ride on not only the coattails, but also learn some of the information we know and continue to expound on that to push many generations down the road up even further, right? It's all about increase and growth and evolving. And that's where I'm looking forward to us. And right now, it's that our children, they're at hand right now. So we're working with them, and you have Rachel into gymnastics. I got my girls in the martial arts to perpetuate that. And also, especially the educational side of it as well, continue to give them the opportunities to learn high value skill sets that they'll be able to utilize in the marketplace and continue to perpetuate that and grow financially within the family as well. All of that encompassing what we're doing. This is all done for the reason which we have started having conversations about this many, many moons ago. Many, many moons ago now. It's good to see the past, the history of all that rich information that has been in the family that I didn't know about, to where it is now and how we can continue to make it rich as well. And going forward.
Yeah, exactly. Now, it's really been a pleasure working with you on the book and all the other projects we worked on together. And, for those who are listening or are viewing, if you get a chance, take a look at the book, Let In But Left Out. The key point that we make in this book is that when we look at the challenges, I think of our family, even, from the point of slavery, and all the things that all of us, generations of different Americans have had to overcome, right? World War I, World War II, the 1918 Spanish flu that we had to survive. Yeah. Vietnam, the civil rights era, 9/11, the Sputnik era, all these things that whenever challenged, we've always risen to the occasion. And the thing that we wrote about in this book was that our concern was that something could happen and go wrong. And right when we were finishing the book, it happened. So we spent 6 weeks revamping the book because coronavirus had just broken out. And we said, listen, if we as Americans can go through all of these trials and tribulations and come out the other side and become better generationally because of it, then we can certainly get through coronavirus. We can certainly get through the era of fake news and impeachments and all of these other things that are currently challenges, globalization, artificial intelligence and technology that is going to really test all of us. So our hope is that we find inspiration in the stories, whether it's Eugene Goodman, who fought there in Washington, D.C., or some of the stories in our family that go from the slave house to the White House right there in Washington, D.C., that everyone can perhaps pick up something, stand on the shoulders of those of the past, and understand that as tough as things are, in many cases, it wasn't as tough as it was for past generations.
Yeah, very true. Very true. Well said.
Well, listen, folks, we waste another hour or so of your time again this week. We appreciate your time. We look forward to catching up with you next week. Again, this is Frank Shines and Grandison.
Grandison Shines.
Out there in Arizona, I'm here in Florida. You guys have a great rest of your week and see you next week. Bye.